The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
In this session, we are going to be covering sort of the Marxist understanding of exploitation and oppression. So much ground to cover, so where do we start? How about climate change? So consider last fall, the hurricanes that ripped through the south of the U.S. mainland and absolutely devastated the island of Puerto Rico. The September Chicago Tribune headline, Black, White, Rich, Poor, Hurricane Harvey did not discriminate. I think we can all agree that this is completely out of touch with reality, right? So while many working class Texans and Floridians lost all of their possessions, in a moment where the poorest half of the U.S. population has less than $1,000 to their name. And while many of the quarter of a million inmates housed in Florida and Texas prisons remain locked in their cells in the midst of mass hurricane evacuations with limited access to food, water, and electricity and proper sanitation. And while the death toll from Hurricane Maria in Puerto Rico is likely 5,000, okay, 70 times the official count, due to still highly unreliable access to the amenities of survival. The rich escape the rising floodwaters to their vacation homes, and the richer still seek to profit off of Puerto Rico's devastation, investing in the privatization of municipalities and education and the education system, as well as the resortification of an evacuated land. So Mike Davis provides an important corrective to the normalization of climate change catastrophe when he writes, climate change is not an alien force threatening all of humanity equally without distinction. Rather, it intensifies the inequalities and conflicts that already exist. So we are in a moment right now, first crystallized during the 2016 election season, in the midst of unabated austerity, poisoned water, and rampant police shootings. The routine explanation of things, the validity of that, has begun to collapse. Ordinary people in mass want answers to the question of social, political, and economic justice. So self-identified intersectional feminist Hillary Clinton diagnosed the system's woes as the racist attitudes of deplorables, and provided nothing more than vacant platitudes, building bridges, not walls, and a promise of 4 more years of Obama's racist and immiserating policies as remedy. On the other hand, self-identified socialist Sanders' message placed the blame on the billionaire class, and not only inspired, but actually organized millions of people. But his subordination of issues of social oppression to economic populism have landed him on the wrong side of questions of racial justice, reproductive justice, and immigrants' rights. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's successful congressional primary campaign has broken out of the limits of the Sanders versus Clinton political parameters, best exemplified in her assertion, I can't think of a race issue that isn't a class issue, and I can't think of a class issue that isn't a race issue. And it hasn't come a minute too soon, right? Trump's zero-tolerance immigration policy, including the imprisonment and torture of migrant children, wholesale denial of asylum to refugees, and a absolutely racist travel ban, is an acceleration of his attempts to shift white ethno-nationalism from the margins to the mainstream. Policies that will deepen immigrants' economic and social vulnerability, and an attempt to conceal the massive redistribution of wealth from the bottom to the top, ushered in by the administration's December tax bill. The revolutionary Marxist tradition provides a critical theoretical framework for those like Ocasio-Cortez who are drawing connections between class inequality and oppression. That one, under capitalism, exploitation and oppression are part of a totality. Two, exploitation and oppression play distinct yet interdependent roles in ensuring capitalist production as well as the reproduction and maintenance of the capitalist system itself. And three, understanding this relationship is essential to determining how to bring the whole barbaric system down. So in this talk, I set out to sketch out this totality, lay out some of the current debates that exist, about how to fight exploitation and oppression. And finally, argue that the Marxist position provides the best way forward. So, as Marxists, we start with an understanding of the economy, or the relations of production. So, the way in which human labor and the means of production, think land, raw materials, buildings, technology, are organized to satisfy our humanly needs and reproduce our humanly selves as the base of the structure, right? So kind of the soil from which everything grows. Capitalism is a class-based economy with a minority exploiting class, the capitalists, that own and control the means of production, and therefore the ways humanly needs are satisfied. Its bottom line is the making of profits, which it achieves through the exploiting of the labor of the majority class, the working class. So that's us. I don't see any monocles or top hats, so I think we're in good company. So in order for us workers who do not control the means of production to satisfy our humanly needs, we must sell our labor power, our ability to work, to make a wage. The bosses only pay us enough for us to afford the cost of reproducing our own labor power. So food, transportation, keeping a roof over our heads, etc., so that we are able to show up to work the next day. So the first portion of our day pays for this cost of reproducing ourselves. And after that, everything else makes up the profits of the capitalist. So the origins of these social relations is commonly boiled down to one of the personal character of two different kinds of people making up two different classes. In Capital, Marx describes these caricatures as one of, on the one hand, the diligent, intelligent, and above all, frugal elite who accumulate wealth, and the other being the lazy rascals spending their substance and more in riotous living who end at the end of, who at the end of the day have nothing left to sell but their skins. However, this account ignores the rather unidyllic historical development of capitalism, the actual entry of capitalism. Capital was forged through the violent expropriation of peasants' lands, the enclosure of commons, and the concentration of the means of production into the hands of a few. So I think that what this shows is that the sort of the base of the relations of production that kind of I think often get highly abstracted can't really ever be separated from oppression, right? Like these things are kind of interwoven at the very beginning of the forging of the system. So the transformation of production under capitalism from individualized to socialized production has made the exploited class under capitalism the most productive class ever to exist. And so with this productive capacity comes the potential for enormous economic, political, and social power, right? So workers then have the potential power to overthrow the current order and the material interest to once and for all rule over society in the interest of the majority. This is why Marx wrote in the Communist Manifesto that capitalism produces its own grave diggers. So in order for the capitalist class to exploit us, they also must oppress us, right? I think that that's kind of evident in the statement I made about the kind of origins of capitalism. As Amy Muldoon writes in a most excellent Socialist Worker article, The Oppressed Majority, the oppression of the working class is, in essence, its exclusion from political, economic, and social power. The working class is systematically excluded from decision-making as a class for the simple reason that capitalism rests on the rule of a minority. This exclusion from any power to control our own lives is as true in political democracies as it is under police states. So whereas our power comes from our labor, the power of the capitalist comes from the state. The state is not, as we're told, some kind of neutral body that sort of coordinates and balances the interests of a bunch of different interest groups, right? As Marx argued in the Communist Manifesto, the executive of the modern state is nothing but a committee for managing the common affairs of the bourgeoisie. And the bourgeoisie is the capitalist, right? Two words mean the same thing. The state serves two vital functions under capitalism. First, the facilitation of capitalist production, so think infrastructure to facilitate transport of commodities, the laws that protect private property, and so on. And the second, as Engels argued in Origins of Family, Private Property, and the State, is to forcibly keep the exploited class in the conditions of oppression determined by the given mode of production, the deployment of the police, National Guard, the military that ensures profits aren't interfered by individual workers and oppressed people. So think like vagrancy laws and broken window policies, or collectives of workers and oppressed people. So think militarized police forces that break up labor strikes and Black Lives Matter protests, as well as ICE facility occupations. So consider the sheriff of Polk County, Florida, who announced his plans to arrest anyone with an outstanding warrant who dared to seek shelter from the hurricanes. Many of those warrants, as is true throughout the country, come about thanks to the buildup of unpaid, unaffordable fines from traffic and pedestrian citations that make up the main source of funding in municipalities because the rich aren't taxed, right? So we don't even need to imagine what it would look like if the people of Polk County stood up against this oppression, because that's exactly what happened in Ferguson. They were met with armored tanks in the streets. The leaders of the movement, of the Black Lives Matter movement, continue to be harassed, brutalized, and killed to this day. So without political, economic, and social control, the hunger in our bellies, the hunger in our bellies compel us to sell our labor, rather than demand capitalists stop hoarding surplus food. And critically, without political, economic, and social control, workers must compete for the few jobs that exist rather than demand the creation of more jobs or control over jobs. So this is critical because it's the primary reason why workers do not band together collectively to fight, because they're constantly competing with each other. On top of this, the ruling class foments these material divisions through their control of intellectual production. So as Marx writes, the ideas of the ruling class are the ruling ideas of any sort of epoch, any kind of mode of production. So take nationalist ideology in an oppressor nation like the US. Ingrained in our public school curriculum, the media, our national pastimes, Trump's Twitter account. As Alan Mass writes in his Socialist Worker piece, again, another amazing piece, read Socialist Worker, what do internationalists say about nationalism? Nationalism is necessary to justify the whole enormous state apparatus that intrudes on people's lives in profound ways and provides a legend to explain why all people within a nation, whether rulers or ruled, are supposedly in it together against all people of other nations. So, you know, the idea is as Americans, we will work harder and longer, report suspicious neighbors, and fight intractable trillion-dollar wars to protect what this country stands for, right? The exceptionalism of the American dream. So take Trump's State of the Union address, where he equated undocumented youth known as dreamers and their families as criminals and said his primary duty was to, quote, defend Americans to protect the safety, their safety, their families, their communities, and their right to the American dream, because Americans are dreamers too. According to this logic, working class Americans have more in common than with the three ruling class Americans who have as much wealth as the poorest 50% than they do with undocumented dreamers, right? We are told it's immigrants who are leeching off the system, while these billionaire, these billionaire pieces of stuff get the tax cuts that are absolutely getting that are absolutely gutting our education and welfare programs. And often the portrayed threat to American values are the supposed enemies within. So they think that the FBI labels a wide range of black activists, from members of the Nation of Islam to Black Lives Matter, as black identity extremists and put them on terrorist watch lists. I think another really good parallel is how Trump suggests that NFL players kneeling should not only be barred from playing, but also deported from the country. Pretty remarkable. How many people have heard about this book, Racecraft? Pretty fucking amazing. I think Barbara and Karen Fields, I think, make a really excellent point in here these sort of ideas can't really stand alone, right? Like they have to be, ideology really only works if it somehow resonates with the actual material conditions, right? And the ruling class's ideology really is only successful in moments where you know, there's low level of struggle. We as workers aren't able to sort of organize and kind of put forward our own ideas. So this nationalist drum beating, racist ideas, sexist ideas, and the rest really only function as ideology, as something that helps people make sense of their world, if it actually corresponds to living experience. So it's effective in dividing workers because some workers are more materially oppressed than others. So workers of color, immigrants, women, LGBT workers, workers of oppressed nations, they experience different forms of special oppression. These various forms of oppression are historically and materially rooted in the various phases of capitalist development. They not only divide workers, but in functioning to further restrict the social, political, and economic power of certain sections of the oppressed to accelerate labor exploitation. And this is really the compulsion of capitalism, right? Can't stay at one. It has to constantly be exponentially growing. So one can't really talk about the genesis of the US nation state without talking about national oppression, black oppression, and the oppression of immigrants. As Marx described in Capital Volume 1, the discovery of gold and silver in America, the extirpation, enslavement, and entombment in mines of the indigenous population of that continent, the beginning of the conquest and plunder of India, the conversion of Africa into the preserve for the commercial hunting of black skins, all things which characterize the rosy dawn of capitalist production. So in the 17th century, Virginia lawmakers in what would become the United States developed the notion of race as a legal justification to first thwart solidarity between African slaves and European servants that were organizing plantation rebellions. Second, to justify the disenfranchisement of African slaves who were becoming increasingly more profitable. And finally, to obscure the contradictions of enslavement in the midst of a movement for national independence and individual liberties. So even in the period of formal equality, black people in this country still experience poorer standards of living by every measure than their white counterparts. In her excellent book, and if you haven't read it yet, I think that should be the first thing on your reading list, From Black Lives Matter to Black Liberation, Kiyenge Mata Taylor describes how the myth of American exceptionalism relies on the linking of black poverty to black cultural failures. She says, "When social and economic crises are reduced to the issues of culture and morality, programmatic or fiscal solutions are never enough. The solutions require personal transformation," right? So the ruling ideology goes. Governments help those who help themselves. How else was it that in 2005, the tragedy of Hurricane Katrina and the malign neglect of the Bush administration doing nothing to save New Orleans black residents could be turned into headlines of looters? So while Manifest Destiny justified the stealing of land throughout the Americas, Caribbean, and Pacific Islands to lay the sort of groundwork, right, for the United States empire, today, it's the fiction that countries like Mexico and Puerto Rico are drains on the U.S. to justify plunder. So foreign control of Mexico's banking system jumped from 1.5 to 74% in just 15 years after the signing of NAFTA. And Puerto Rico, in 2018, a literal colonial subject, is governed through the unelected U.S. Congress-appointed debt restructuring board, PROMESA. PROMESA has propped open the door for a major looting of the island in the wake of Hurricane Maria. And when it comes to the oppression of immigrants, we have to look at the rapid industrial expansion of the 19th century. U.S. capital had relied on immigrants as a highly flexible and highly exploitable pool of labor. So this kind of has resulted in this completely contradictory ruling ideology and policies on immigration. We kind of had sort of seen. I've been alive for 30 years and seen lots of swings. So opening the idea that we can open borders to let in the sturdy, malleable, good immigrant yearning for freedom, to ramp up competition between workers in times of labor shortage, and to break up the labor struggles for better compensation on the one hand. And the closing of borders to the brown menace in periods of economic downturn, or when the ruling class is in need of an ideological enemy to wage war abroad or at home. And you know, I think it's we're seeing what Trump is doing right now, and I think it is qualitatively different than anything we've ever seen before. But it's really important to know that before Trump, Obama was the deporter in chief, and for good reason, deporting more immigrants than any president combined in the 20th century. And you know, while Trump demands this physical, unperforated wall, the Democrats' idea of comprehensive immigration reform is a more civil and more fiscally conservative sort of virtual wall, right, with sensors and armored vehicles and things like that. So that's kind of like the schematic sort of like way that we kind of see these, the way that things are linked together. Is everything kind of clear? Would people like to think pair share, or should I just keep on talking? Yeah, keep on going. Okay. So how should the fight against oppression and inequality in our society be carried out? Right? That's the big question. So I want to return to the Sanders versus Clinton dichotomy because I think it continues to frame much of the mainstream political debate, especially in the run-up to the midterms, right? So to recap, Bernie and the sort of our revolution camp that has sort of grown out of that says, yes, racism and sexism are problems, but attacking class inequality will resolve everything, right, on one side. And for the Clintonites, ending racism is a matter of returning to civility and examining our individual racist biases through dialogue and conversation. For what is dialogue without conversation? Activists and intellectuals rightfully criticize Sanders for focusing on economic inequality without an analysis of the race of the way racist policies impact these disparities. So even many of Sanders' supporters are disappointed with his failure to get behind the demand to abolish ICE. But his position is actually consistent with his longtime claim that border enforcement is necessary to protect American jobs. Most notable was Sanders' response to the idea of reparations for Black Americans as very divisive. He explained, the real issue is when we look at the poverty rate among African American communities, we have a lot of work to do. What we should be talking about is making massive investments in rebuilding our cities and creating decent paying jobs, in making public colleges and universities tuition free, basically targeting our federal resources to the areas where it is needed the most, and where it is needed the most is in impoverished communities, often African American and Latino. I think there's a lot of good things about this, but I think Ta-Nehisi Coates was correct in characterizing Sanders' response as a class-first approach. He argued, Sanders' basic approach is to ameliorate the effects of racism through broad, mostly class-based policies, and that this was inadequate in addressing the non-economic effects of racism. So Sanders supporters like Seth Aukerman sort of defend his position, writing in Jacobin, here's my question. To the angry commentators, if racial inequality isn't merely a symptom of economic inequality, what is it a symptom of? What were slavery, colonialism, Jim Crow, and urban apartheid if not extreme forms of economic inequality? In response to Aukerman, ISO member Jen Rush, you should go to the talk directly after this, Jen Rush's talk about why, what makes workers fight, because I think it really goes along with this one, if you're interested. She writes, such commentary adds fuel to the accusation that socialism and Marxism cares not about the questions of racism and oppression, as it relies on the crudest economic reductionism and only serves to further cement the trope that leftists refuse to grapple seriously with racism. There is also plenty to disagree with when it comes to Ta-Nehisi Coates, especially in his essay for The Atlantic, Trump is the First White President. Pretty sure we've had a lot of white presidents before Trump who acted in very white ways. In his essay, he contends that Trump's presidency is a product of cross-class coalition of whiteness, a collective white lash against the insult of 8 years of a Black president. So according to Coates, any attempt to understand the rise of Trump involving even the most perfunctory class analysis marks a denial of the role of anti-black racism as the one true cause of Trump's election. So he argues, to say that the rise of Donald Trump is about more than race is to make an empty statement, one that is small comfort to the people, black, Muslim, immigrant, who live under racism's boot. So I think this argument is pretty consistent with a lot of what he writes in Between the World and Me, where he sort of characterizes racism and whiteness as some eternal, even cosmic injustice, which I think is kind of, doesn't quite resonate with the historical facts of the, you know, the beginnings of racism not being something that is eternal, like we sort of talked about earlier. So I think, like many in the Afro-pessimist tradition, Coates' work provides a brilliant and devastating account of racism in the U.S. that must be celebrated. Not the racism in the U.S., but his account. But I agree with Asad Haider in his new book, Mistaken Identity, that the analysis his identity politics puts forward has sort of a neutralizing effect on struggle for systemic change. So it divides divides the line of class between races rather than that between exploiters and exploited. So in erasing class distinction amongst whites, and I think that the best example would be how actually the working class whites were not really Trump's base, weren't really the ones who were predominantly voting for Trump. It was actually the middle class, just to kind of side note. So I think that in erasing the class distinctions among whites, Coates also, I think, falls into some of the very trappings, not all of course, but some of the very trappings of white supremacist ideology. As Kianga Yamada Taylor writes, the concerted effort of the political establishment to link black poverty to black culture and black families functions to render black and poverty synonymous. In doing so, it also renders white poverty invisible. So I think her book lays out some pretty telling statistics. So while black people are twice as likely to live below the poverty line as whites, there are twice as many white people living in poverty as black people. In the US, there are 2,300 black people behind bars for every 100,000 and for whites, it's 450 to every 100,000. This is an absolutely outrageous disparity, but it's important to note that the incarceration rate of white people in America alone is still higher than almost any other country in the world. So concealing these facts are essential in perpetuating the myth of American exceptionalism. So in the case where white poverty is impossible to ignore, so I think, you know, looking at the reversal of life expectancy due to the diseases of despair, opioid epidemic, alcoholism, and suicide, I think that when it's impossible to erase white poverty is sort of depicted as like an exception, right? White trash, the underclass, as an abomination to white culture. Because otherwise it begs the question, right? If the overwhelming majority of white people in this society aren't benefiting from the system, then who is? So whereas Coates says that we are not taking racism seriously if we are talking about class, Kianga says that you can't really fight racism without an analysis of racism as rooted in capitalism. So I think also, I just want to say though, I think we must be crystal clear in our critique of identity politics, right? I think that there can be this sort of way where we kind of very sharply reject it wholesale. I think that the essentialist politics of Coates is not flawed in its elevating of identity-based oppression, right? I think this is something that has a vitality and a validity of its own. But the real issue of it is that it sees racial attitudes as the root cause and most likely unrootable, right? And the struggle of the oppressed as futile. The struggle of the oppressed, even for modest demands such as respect, equal access, formal equality, kind of modest compared to the demand for revolutionary change, still will play a critical role in incapacitating capital's ability to disorganize the struggles against its rule. So I think the civil rights movement is a prime example. Thank you. Oh, dang. The civil rights movement is a prime example. Jack Blum's history of in class, race, and the civil rights movement is an excellent account. The character and demands of the civil rights movement have often been characterized as middle class, right? Equal access to restaurants and theaters, to department stores and hotels, to housing and hospitals, could only materially benefit those with the wherewithal to pay. Nonetheless, in the early days of the civil rights movement, there was widespread support for these battles amongst black people, even the black working class, because of the common denominator, which was human dignity. But as formal equality was being won in the South, the epicenter of the struggle moved north, where formal equality actually laid bare the deep economic inequality experienced by black people, both as workers and as black. And as the demands for redistribution of wealth and power became the demands of the black freedom movement, the class distinctions within the movement were brought into sharp relief, right? So Blum writes, former allies of the battle against Southern intransigence, the Northern middle class, the Democratic Party, and the federal government, they refused to take the path asked of them. More concessions were ruled out. Blum argues, the urban rebellions in the North were not primarily a protest of the segregated racial system of Southern oppression, they were a protest of the American class system as it particularly affected black people. Ultimately, it was the calls for black power and the militancy in the North, think like the rebellions that were happening in major cities, that pressured the Johnson administration to implement the war on poverty, a set of social reforms that disproportionately buoyed the black working class out of poverty, or at least more of it than was before, but for whom white people made up the majority of beneficiaries, because they're the majority of the population. King's book details polls taken in 67 that show the drastic shift in white opinion towards support of the improvement of the conditions of the black community, as well as the support for anti-poverty programs in general. I think that the unfolding events of the civil rights movement confirm many of the claims made by Trinidadian Marxist C.L.R. James many decades before, who saw the dialectics of the black struggle as having a, quote, vitality and validity of its own, the ability to intervene with terrific force on the general social and political life of the nation, that has a real contribution to make to the development of the proletariat and is in itself a constituent part of the struggle for socialism, right? And often playing, the black working class playing a vanguard role, so a leading role in the struggle for revolution in a socialist society. So the dialectics of the black struggle in some advance the class. The rising of the oppressed is necessary for both advancing freedom of the oppressed and weakening capital's grip on the whole class. But if the struggle against oppression and the struggle for greater economic equality, for that matter, is a means in and of itself, the motive capitalist production actually remains intact, and these gains are constantly at threat. So this is why we say that the working class is the agent of social change, not because it's endowed with some sort of inherent virtue, but because of its class interest to end exploitation and the oppression that makes it possible, and its economic potential to do so. The development of workers' consciousness to become, as Marx said, not only a class in itself, but a class for itself, and the struggle for socialism will depend on the solidarity of the whole class in fighting against oppression of all of its constituent parts. So I think another example, like looking at organized labor, if it's to live up to its potential, it can play a major part in this role. So I think it's no small thing looking at the red state teacher strike wave, made up of predominantly women, whose demands were for better wages, better working conditions, and better healthcare, has coincided with the Me Too movement. I think it's also happening in the context of an even more advanced global feminist movement for abortion rights and against gendered violence. And this is also happening at the same time that Trump's Supreme Court pick will spell out the end of Roe versus Wade. Kind of looking at all of these things together. So imagine the way in which if organized labor was to actually take up the demands of the oppressed, right? To take up the demands for universal or healthcare for all, Medicare for all, but also the demand for abortion, free abortion on demand without apologies. You could see the way in which this would actually, could even move out of being a sectoral struggle of teachers, but also one that can kind of spread across the class in inciting women workers in a bunch of different sectors. So kind of what Rosa Luxemburg talked about with the mass strike, how labor can fight for not only economic demands, but also when it touches the whole class, can also fight for political demands as well. So given the talents of capital to disorganize our side, this won't come easy. This is why organized revolutionary socialists participating in mass social and labor struggles is so critical, right? So I think What Is to Be Done, written by Lenin back in 1901, sort of describes what this kind of organized revolutionary socialist should look like, and also describes what the party should look like, right? So he says, the Revolutionary Party to be the must be the tribune of the oppressed, able to react to every manifestation of tyranny and oppression, no matter where it appears, no matter what stratum or class of people it affects, who is able to generalize all these manifestations and produce a single picture of police violence and capitalist exploitation, who is able to take advantage of every event, however small, in order to set forth before all his socialist convictions and his democratic, and also her democratic demands, in order to clarify for all and everyone the world historic significance of the struggle for the emancipation of the proletariat. Thank you.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out WeAreMany.org.